First case on calendar this morning, In Re, the ATS 1998 Trust, 67040. If the parties are ready, I go ahead and proceed. If you wish to reserve any time, please self-state, and please note your appearance for the record.
Good morning. May I please reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal? May it please the court. My name is Marla Hudgens, and I represent the appellant in this case, Laura Tompkins. In Nevada, as in most states across this country, the presumption is attorneys' fees will be paid by civil litigants. They will pay their own fees. This is the case even where there is a clear and unmistakable prevailing party, and even where that prevailing party is required to participate in discovery that is expensive or that it considers unreasonable. In order to overcome that presumption, there must be something more to the case. That would be either a contract, a rule, or a statute that shifts fees. Here, there was no valid contractual basis to shift fees, and so the district court went searching for an arbitrary basis to grant fees anyways. In other words, the district court first decided that it wanted Laura Tompkins, my client, to pay Susan Pillsbury's fees, and so it went searching for a statute or a rule that would govern the case. The question in this case is really whether a plaintiff that seeks limited discovery on a statute of limitations defense acts vexatiously by doing so. Here, the district court imposed a loser's pay rule that would have broad implications beyond just the statute of limitations defense. Any party that seeks discovery where the alternative is dismissal of its claims would pay the other party's fees if discovery does not materialize.
Let's go back. You talked in terms of this rule and you talked in terms of the statute of limitations. Isn't there some obligation imposed upon the attorney before they file suit to figure out whether or not there is a statute of limitations issue?
Certainly there is. However, because the statute of limitations involves a discovery rule, that is when the client knew or should have known of the particular accrual of the claim, in this case, what counsel did was ask for an accounting over a period of years for a trust. That very courteous request was rejected out of hand by the trust with very little explanation other than simply that the trust was terminated. No particular date of the trust termination, no other details of the...
Wasn't it roughly, I guess, 12 years from the distribution of the trust?
No, it was not. No. The last distribution of the trust was in late 2007. The request was in 2012. So it was roughly 4 to 5 years. The statute of limitations that governs this case is 3 years. So under that theory, there is a legitimate basis to believe that perhaps the statute of limitations had not run. For example, if an accounting showed that trust assets were fraudulently dispersed or that there was some fraud involved in that, that would require discovery of those.
But didn't your client get a K-1 that said, here's your final distribution, here it is, in 2008?
There's two answers to that. The first is that the K-1 document that had been sent around, several K-1s have been sent each year. My client is not a sophisticated party. She had no reason to know or understand what a K-1 document meant, including what a final K-1 stood for. The second problem with the K-1 document is, as the district court noted, the K-1 document had the incorrect address on it. So where you have an incorrect address, the court decides that there's a credible basis to do discovery. So the court says, okay, on page 595 of the record, the district court summarized the issue. Judge Sermon says, we have this issue where there was at least inquiry notice and you're looking to do discovery on the issue whether your client was on actual or inquiry notice. Okay, I see. All right, I'll allow that. And she notes specifically, the one thing that concerns me is that the K-1 has the wrong address on it. That was a concern to the court. And based on that, there was a credible basis to do limited discovery. Limited discovery, as this court knows, is not an ordinary. It happens under Rule 56F. It happens where there is an inclination to dismiss for personal jurisdiction.
Right, but the K-1 was in your client's possession, correct?
The K-1...
She would have gotten a copy of it and filed it with the IRS with her return.
The significance of the K-1 to my client wasn't meaningful for the purpose of accruing the claims in this case. So she has an accountant, okay, that's hired by the trustee herself. That particular accountant never discussed the trust at all with my client. And that is indicated on page 1142 of the record. During Mr. Wyckoff's deposition, the accountant, he says that he never discussed at any time with Laura Tompkins the trust. So that accounting document to an unsophisticated party who has no accounting background, no tax background, meant very little to her.
But should the other side be held responsible because your client didn't understand what a K-1 was? I assume she signs a tax return. K-1 goes on Schedule E on your 1040. I mean, you have to, when you sign your tax return, you got to kind of understand what the stuff is and what it means and all like that. So I'm sure Mr. Eccles is going to argue that's not their client's problem, you know, the fact that she didn't investigate it. What's your response to that?
That she didn't investigate what a K-1 meant?
Yeah, because the K-1 would have every bit of information on it that you could mold. You could take her percentage of whatever it was, multiply it out. It would have every category of every item that the trust has on it. It's all there. It's in that information. It's in the K-1.
The significance of the K-1 document didn't actually become known to my client until the probate commissioner said, listen, I'm a former CPA. When I look at a K-1, final K-1, that means it's the last distribution, you're done, that starts the running of your claims.
Right.
My client says that that has no it didn't have significance at that particular time. And so the only thing I want to do is some limited discovery to determine what other information that there was. Notably, throughout the case, there was email traffic, between the parties, phone calls.
But your client's also on email threads back in 2008 that would have been her email, right?
She is on email threads. Those email...
And she didn't share them with her counsel? I mean, I don't want to delve too deeply into this, but I'm hard-pressed to understand how she didn't know this was time-barred.
The actual accrual of her claims is not indicated in those emails. The emails that we're talking about weren't produced actually by either party. They were produced by the accountant. So Susan had access to them. Laura had access to them. Ultimately, it was an accountant that comes on the day of his deposition, 14 months after the petition.
But they were also in her email account had she wanted to go back and give them to her lawyer in evaluating the soundness of this dispute, right?
In affidavits that appear in the record in this case, what my client has indicated is that email address was a previously used email address that she didn't have access to and wasn't using at the time of the filing of the case. So it turns out that both Laura didn't recall immediately those emails and Susan didn't recall immediately those emails. Otherwise, they would have been produced at least by Susan right away. The statute of limitations is ultimately the defendant's burden to prove. Susan had the obligation then, once asserting the defense, to bring forth evidence of that defense.
Ms. Hutchins, can I ask you one other question on
yes.
The attorney's fees? By the way, we may agree with you, just for the party's benefit. We ask tough questions to both sides. When we ask a question, it doesn't mean we're leaning that way. We just want to know. Try and get all the information here. There also is a claim for attorney's fees about prior counsel for Ms. Pillsbury. I think was part of the attorney's fees award. Was that correct?
Are you referring to the fees of Jolly Erga?
Yeah, it was prior counsel.
Right.
And my review of this indicated it was awarded as a court cost as opposed to award of attorney's fees. Did I read that wrong, or what's your position on that?
You're correct. As a cost in this case, $1,500 was awarded. And those fees are attributed to Jolly Erga providing legal services.
But is the word is a cost as opposed to attorney's fees?
Correct.
So I'm not sure how you can word attorney's fees as a cost, but I'm sure we'll hear from the other side on that.
I agree with you.
Your time is slipping away. You have about 5:18, but before you sit down, I'd like you to comment about the distribution of the award of attorney's fees pursuant to the EDCR 7.60 sub B rule, in essence, sanction, so to speak.
Right. I'll answer your question. I would argue that this was absolutely not a sanctionable offense in this case for Laura to ask for limited discovery. Once an email was actually produced, she said, okay, I've seen the email. I think this gives some credibility to the statute of limitations defense. I'm going to agree to have my claims dismissed, and we can all move on. This isn't a whole lot different from what happened in Dominick versus Dominick, where a party was challenging a prenuptial agreement and gone through a significant amount of discovery in that case, and then within days or weeks right before an evidentiary hearing, that particular party says, you know what, I'll stipulate the validity of the prenuptial agreement. And the court refused to award fees, saying that that party was not only not a prevailing party, but that we're not going to discourage litigants from voluntarily.
So this was dismissing. A stipulated dismissal of this proceeding?
Correct.
Okay, so one of your arguments was if it's a stipulated dismissal, there's no prevailing party, so there's no basis to award attorney's fees. Then.
Right, and not only is there not a prevailing party, but there certainly isn't vexatious, harassing, unreasonable conduct. In fact, that's the type of conduct that I believe this court would want to promote.
Can I ask you one more question? I'm sorry to take
that's
your time,
okay.
But we're trying to get this in. Now, I anticipate the other side is going to get up and say, appellate judges, even if you don't agree with Judge Sturman, you have to defer to her on her factual findings regarding the bad faith or whatever under 18010 to award the attorney's fees. What's your response to that going to be?
This court is not required to defer to those findings because they're not explained. They're simply conclusory. For example, in paragraphs 8 and 9 of the conclusions of law, it simply says Laura acted groundlessly. Laura acted by harassing Susan. There's no explanation of why or how. It's simply a conclusory finding, and the record does not support it.
Okay, thank you.
I'm going to give you additional minutes, so you have 4 minutes when you get back up. And I'll give counsel an additional minute.
Good morning, Your Honors. Micah Eccles for respondent, cross-appellant Susan Pillsbury. So let me just clear something up. This was not a stipulated dismissal. Page 887 of the record demonstrates that it was actually an affirmance. What it was is there was a dismissal at the probate commissioner level, then there was an appeal to the district court, then Judge Sturman allowed some limited discovery, and then after Laura decided she didn't want to go forward with that after the emails were discovered, she withdrew her appeal, and the resulting order was an affirmance. So the only
there's no stipulation signed to withdraw that challenge to the recommendations to the probate commissioner.
So there is a stipulation that withdraws her appeal, but there is a separate later order which adopts the report and recommendation. And so what we have before the court today is not an appeal from the report and recommendation. It's only from the separate fees order which came later. And I think that's important because the way the briefs were written, the way the arguments presented today, they want to challenge the findings of fact, but those findings of fact haven't been appealed. They can't be challenged. And so the court's bound by those. Judge Sturman was bound by those. This court's bound by those. There's no jurisdiction over any of these findings. They're basically set in stone. And I'm looking at page.
So the stipulation didn't vacate the underlying findings articulated by the probate commissioner?
Not at all, Your Honor. We would have never done that.
But what do you say to her point that as soon as the emails were discovered and as soon as she understood what the tax return documents meant, she did stand down on this lawsuit. She did not persist in pursuing it further. And indeed, Ms. Hutchins makes a fair point that we want to encourage that if you know, to stop the litigation machinery if you recognize it's likely not going anywhere good for your client. What do you say to that?
I think there's a distinction, Your Honor. between withdrawing claims and withdrawing appeals, because this was not a 56F situation. This is an appeal out of a special master order. The timing of this is important, too. At the January 28, 2014 hearing before Judge Sturman, she says, I think this is a pretty thin claim that you're making here, counsel. And just so you know, if you go out and do this limited discovery and find that you actually, your client actually had inquiry notice, there's going to be some cost shifting. And so there, and counsel said, we know, we understand that, we're prepared to deal with that. The other timing of the email is interesting because it was on the evening before Laura's deposition. Had previous counsel, Paul Hemanowski, been able to depose Laura, we would have been able to find out a lot more about her state of mind, the reason why she did things, instead of just having the argument at counsel. I hope I answered your question, Anna. So the report and recommendation from the probate commissioner, which were later affirmed, these really tell the story aside from what counsel's tried to argue in the briefs. Paragraph 7, this is page 431. Susan Tompkins Pillsbury provided the beneficiaries with an accounting in 2006. Why did she even need to file this lawsuit? She already had the accounting. Final distributions were made in December 2007. That's a finding of fact. There's no getting around that.
Well, what about her argument? She didn't understand what the K-1, the final K-1 meant, and it's probably 9 out of 10 people don't, you know, I would guess, when they get their tax returns and all. Is that a basis to excuse further inquiry here?
Not at all, Your Honor. In fact, in her affidavit, and this is Laura's affidavit, in the probate commissioner proceedings, she acknowledged in there, I received the K-1. This wasn't the first K-1 she'd received. She'd received others from other years of distributions. So it's not like it's a foreign document.
I thought there was the wrong address on it or something, or said issue. Is that incorrect?
That is incorrect, Your Honor, because she only raised that issue for the first time in the district court when she submitted a new affidavit or a new declaration saying, oh, now I think I didn't get it. But that's a Valley Health Systems issue where you can't raise new evidence for the first time in district court when you're dealing with Rule 53 proceedings. So she changed her tune on that issue. Also goes to the case we cited, the Aldabi versus Adams. You can't submit competing sworn statements from the same person to create a factual issue. And Judge Sturman was reluctant. That's why she limited the discovery. And it's not routine on an appeal from a Rule 53 probate proceeding to allow additional discovery. The claim that was made during the January 28, 2014 hearing before the district court was there are millions of dollars missing, which has never been substantiated. But that's why the judge, I think, was persuaded to say, okay, well, let's see what happens here.
What about this issue on the attorney's fees on the Jolly Erga part? What was the basis of that award, and what was it awarded under what provision?
So NRS 18.05 sub 5 is the expert witness costs. And Judge Sturman, because it was a non-testifying expert, Judge Sturman limited that to...
They weren't doing it as legal fees for...
No, Your Honor. In fact, our client had, he was basically a consulting expert, is how those were justified. And because he was a non-testifying expert, consistent with more recent case law, was limited to $1,500.
But it was awarded, that's because it's a cost, expert witness cost, as opposed to legal fees for counsel representing a party, then.
That's correct, Your Honor. In the order on fees and costs, there is a line item in there for professional services of about $7,700. That's not Jolly Erga. That's for Mr. Wyckoff, because as he charged his hourly rate, much like a testifying physician or a treating physician or an expert would charge, and the parties agreed to pay that. And so that's what that was for. That's not the Jolly Erga fees or costs.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor. So back to the commissioner's report and recommendation, paragraph 10 on page 432, April 2008, K-1 tax form is marked as final on three places. and then it talks all about the subtrusts, which is really an issue for the next case. And then probably one of the best lines out of the report and recommendations and conclusions of law, the uncontroverted evidence irrefutably demonstrates that Laura Tompkins discovered or should have discovered the facts giving rise to her alleged cause of action as early as November of 2007 and no later than the issuance of the final Form K-1 in April of 2008. So if you look at that conclusion of law in the context of Judge Sterman's fees order, it makes perfect sense, Your Honors, that she had no basis to file this lawsuit, which really goes to our cross-appeal. Because what Judge Sterman did is she said, I'm not going to give you guys all of your attorney's fees from day one. I'm going to limit those to the time when I gave you notice in the January 28, 2014 hearing. So that was the $72,000 from that point forward.
Well, how did she abuse her discretion in doing that, in your view? Hmm.
Well, our argument is there's a couple of different points. Number one is, if you look at the Watson Rounds case, it talks about that each legal basis needs to be analyzed separately for an award of fees. So she kind of just said, I'll award my fees under 18102B, EDCR 7.60B, and then my inherent authority based on the Emerson versus District Court case. And our point was, Judge, you can award fees under 18.0102B for the whole duration of the case if the whole case was frivolous. But she only took it from the point of giving notice. Almost the argument we've made is that she read in a Rule 11 notice provision, which is not present in 18.0102B. And so what we'd like on that is we'd like a remand and so that the judge can explain why she read that into the statute when it doesn't exist.
Counsel, why shouldn't we apply the general rule, which basically each party bears their own attorney's fees in probate-type actions?
Okay, so the American rule of that counsel talked about contract statute.
Yeah, I'm looking specifically at NRS 165-143 sub 7.
Okay.
And if not, petitioner looking at fees and costs pursuant to 153.031 sub 3. And anyway, pursuant to Nevada rules, there's another subsection.
And I do remember that argument in the briefs, Your Honor. Basically, there's nothing in that statute that says it's the exclusive remedy for the recovery of attorney's fees and costs. And if I remember the language right, it only applies to petitioners. We weren't the petitioner in this case. And so there's nothing that prevents on appeal the application of the laws and the inherent authority that the court did apply. Now here's another part of our cross appeal. So I'm thinking of the Mona versus District Court case the court recently published, where it said that the trustee of a trust is a stranger to the individual, that same individual, for purposes of, I think it was for service of process. In this case, we cited the Cleveland Sixth Circuit case, and there's a handful of cases that follow Cleveland. And it's the same kind of idea here. Is we have Susan Pillsbury, who is the trustee of the ATS Trust. Trust is terminated, it's closed, everything's distributed. But now, all these years later, she has to personally bear the responsibility for all the attorney's fees. And so it doesn't make sense for her individually to have to pay what should have been an expense to her as trustee. And what we've tried to do is take the Cleveland case and kind of that model and apply it to this court's precedent. I think it was first brought up in Sandy Valley with the special damages. But the case that I always refer to is the Rolling Plains case that talks about contractors and, you know, a party causes you to get into litigation with a third party, then you can recover those fees against the party that caused that as special damages. And we really see this as being the same thing. Laura caused Susan Pillsbury individually to get into litigation to defend the trust.
Were there claims made by Ms. Tompkins against Ms. Pillsbury as an individual, or were they all in her capacity as a trustee?
You know, as far as I know, Your Honor, they were all against her as trustee. They alleged breach of fiduciary duty. There may have been some personal surcharge claims, but...
Well, I mean, the reason I asked them, any award, you know, attorney's fees would have to be made her in her representative capacity, not individually, if that's what the claims were asserted on.
Correct? Certainly. And at the end of the day, because we're dealing with a closed trust, there's only one place they could have come from, is from her personally. She didn't have any more assets of the trust to expend.
Can you talk to me about the facts relative to Susan's initial response when either the demand or the petition was filed? In other words, it comes out of in 2012 or whenever it is, and there'd been a wrap-up and a distribution and a K-1 and everything back in 2007, 2008. On a reading of the briefs, Susan's response was, but I don't get exactly when it occurred. Look, we wrapped this up years ago. The accounting was given then. Why did this get so far and generate so much in fees?
So what happened is Laura filed her petition. I think it was a period of about 8 months before the response was filed. Attached to our motion for fees in the district court, it kind of identifies what was going on up there. Jay Larson, counsel here in town, drafted the ATS trust. He approached Laura's counsel and said, hey, you guys want an accounting? Here's the accounting that we've already given to you. But
when did he do that?
That was within a month or so of receiving the petition. Hey, can we settle this case? If you want an accounting, here's an accounting. Jay Larson actually gave him two accountings. And they said, they received the accounting, said, okay, you still have to respond to the suit. Elizabeth Brickfield then made an appearance. She gave another accounting and said, do we really need to do this? And, you know, in our position, at a minimum, the frivolous fees should extend back to that date. If the whole purpose of the lawsuit was to get an accounting and they got three accountings, what really was the purpose of going forward after that point? Other than what Judge Sturman found was to harass Susan, vex her, and annoy her. So one of the other issues on our cross appeal is we awarded the $72,000 in fees, but we had asked for $214,000 in fees. There's no explanation given other than she chose that date when she warned them. And there's the Henry Products versus Tarmu case that we cited in our brief that just said if there's a drastic reduction in the request of fees, we just need a reason. We need to know why. And as a practical reason, it makes it nearly impossible for this court to determine why the district court did that.
But what's the standard of review that applies to our review of her determination of the appropriate start date?
Well, if it's factual, it's abuse of discretion. If it's a legal issue, then it's de novo. And if it's mixed, which this probably would be, depending how you apply the legal rule to the situation, then it's whichever one predominates.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
I want to start by answering Mr. Eccles' comments and argument that this was an appeal. And by the fact that this was an appeal, the rule that we want to promote, which is walking away from claims amicably, doesn't apply. This court has not found that to be true. For example, in Breeden versus 8th Judicial District Court, which was ruled upon in 2015, a writ petition was filed challenging a district court's order, and an answer was ordered. The respondent filed an answer, and after filing the answer, the petitioner decided, you know what, I don't want to follow through with this petition anymore. I'd like to withdraw my petition. The respondent, after going through time, money, expense, et cetera, to answer the petition, sought fees. And this court held that, quote, normally courts encourage rather than discourage voluntary self-determined case resolutions.
But isn't this slightly different? If we had a master make a ruling, it meant that the parties had opened the litigation, they disputed it, it went to the special master for their recommendation. They made the recommendation where the two parties were at odds. And thereafter, according to what has been stated, then we had a withdrawal. We didn't have a withdrawal prior to the special master making the recommendation. Is that different? If not, why?
I would say it's not different because you also have the district court making a ruling in between that says, okay, the K-1 has the wrong address on it. I'm going to allow limited discovery. There's a credible or reasonable basis to do limited discovery. The district court also made a point.
Does that K-1 alter the findings of the special master?
Yes, it does. It certainly does. The K-1 document was found by the probate commissioner to be one of the key pieces of evidence, if not the key piece of evidence, to demonstrate the accrual from a discovery rule standpoint of the statute of limitations.
Was counsel mistaken when he inferred that the parties allowed you to see the prior information as to the accounting?
Accounting documents were sent to Ms. Tompkins after filing the petition. We requested them originally. That was rejected. The petition was filed, and then the accounting documents were provided. During that period of time, there was email traffic both ways saying, we would like to resolve this. Can you please provide some backup documentation to show that Laura actually received these documents? And each email, for example, from Ms. Brickfield saying she received them, I'll get back to you on the dates, etc. What evidence do you have of the statute of limitations actually accruing? There was a continued request for that. That document was ultimately produced, as I said, by an accountant, even though Susan also had access to those documents. So you have a 14-month period in time where there's allegations going both ways about who's cooperative, who's not cooperative, and ultimately what you have is a case of ordinary litigiousness. This court doesn't punish or uphold sanctions for litigiousness. It has to be vexatious conduct or harassing conduct. If the district court's ruling stands, what ends up happening is every single time there's limited discovery awarded, that provides a basis. If that discovery doesn't pan out to find the result that the party was seeking, for a request for fees for that discovery period, is legally indefensible.
Thank you. We'll take a couple of minutes to thank counsel for their argument as to this.